Port Townsend Film Festival 2018 Filmmaker Interviews on KPTZ. Thanks for being with us. I'm Larry Stein. Every year we cover the film festival in many ways, and each year we do filmmaker interviews ahead of the festival to highlight some of the notable films and filmmakers involved in the festival each year. In this program, we'll be hearing about two films, Worlds of Ursula K. Le Guin, about the science fiction writer whose work stretched well beyond the label of science fiction to become part of the American literary canon at this point. She passed away earlier this year. And we'll hear about Intelligent Lives from director Dan Habib. First, Worlds of Ursula K. Le Guin.
When I started writing, the sort of basic assumption about fiction was that men were at the center of it.
You have this really pretty masculine, pretty male-dominated world.
I don't know how many times I was told I write well.
But we don't know quite what you're doing.
Ursula doesn't set herself up as a giver of answers, but she is one of the...
You're listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. I'm Larry Stein. We're going to be talking to Arwen Curry, the director, producer-director of one of the notable films in the very chock-full Port Townsend Film Festival coming up starting September 21st. Arwen Curry is a veteran documentary producer down in California. She made a film called Worlds of Ursula K. Le Guin, one of the favorite writers I know of our region. We have quite an active literary community here, and her books are always on prominent display at our main bookstore. Arwen, thank you for taking a few minutes to talk to us about your film.
My pleasure, Larry.
So how did you get connected with Ursula K. Le Guin?
So I originally got connected with Ursula through a mutual friend, another writer in Portland named Mo Bostern. And I wrote to Ursula through the usual means. I wrote her a letter explaining what I wanted to do to make this documentary about her work and her life. And Mo kind of said, Ursula, you know, you can take this person seriously, which was, I think, important because Ursula was under a constant deluge, as you can imagine. And so I was very lucky to kind of come to her attention. And then our relationship grew over the course of the decade that it took to make the film. And I think, you know, the trust grew along with that once we started actually working together, filming and putting together the documentary.
Mm-hmm. She spent her life, in a way, fighting the outsider status of the kind of literature that she wrote. She was a voice that was saying things way ahead of its time, in a way. And in the film, she mentions how the time somehow caught up with her.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, the story we're trying to tell in the film has a lot to do with her marginalization as a woman writer, as a writer in the genres of fantasy and science fiction, which was, you know, considered this kind of juvenile form of literature when she began working in it, and which, you know, through the course of her career, she really was instrumental in elevating to a serious form of literature, which is now open to anyone who wants to work there. It's been very interesting working over the last 10 years with Ursula, because I've really seen her become kind of entrenched into the canon in a way that I hadn't seen right at the beginning. You know, it was sort of, you could feel it becoming clear to the literary community at large, the sort of wider American literary community, that this was one of our living treasures.
That's
and
right.
That she was not some writer on the fringe out by the Pacific Ocean to these publishers in New York, but someone that was extremely important to our national literature. And it was great to be able to see that in the last few years before her death.
The wing of fantasy and science fiction that she excelled at, and it's described in your film as creating worlds, something about world making. She created a lot of societies and created worlds that were alternatives. They were something different than what we have here. And that went on to be, of course, a very, very popular area of fantasy and science fiction now that you see all the time now.
Yeah, that's right. I think people think about science fiction when they're not familiar with it as something having to do with these trappings of ray guns and, you know, aliens, monsters, and spaceships. And really, the trappings are not what's exciting about it. And Ursula understood what's at the heart what the real promise of science fiction is, which is this project of inventing a very convincing, very real other world in which people can explore ideas in new ways and ultimately look freshly at our own world, having just had their perception shaken up by this other reality that she crafted so beautifully.
One thing that's really interesting for me, since I went to the UC, University of California system, and I studied anthropology and sociology, the connection she had, the K in Ursula K. Le Guin, K stands for Kroeber, and anybody who's been in the social sciences, especially in California, knows the name Kroeber. Her father was Alfred Kroeber. Why don't you fill in where he fits? And when you see the family that she grew up in and the exposure she had, there's such a direct linkage to the way she looked at worlds and societies.
Right. So Ursula's father, Alfred Kroeber, was an extremely important figure in Western anthropology. He was sort of the father of Western anthropology, learning about the cultures of many peoples who were being persecuted actively, being pushed down culturally, and being basically marginalized and co-opted and persecuted in various ways. And he was collecting this information and learning about these cultures. And I think because Ursula's childhood was so full of these fascinating figures, both the informants of her father and his anthropological colleagues, also refugees from fascism in Europe, all these people coming through her family's life, gave her the understanding that there wasn't just one way to see the world, that many cultures existed, each with their own perception. And she had that deep relativity within her, I think, as a young person, and she took it into her work in this wonderful way, where she uses these alternate universes to explore different ways of being human, similarly to how her father did it in his work. And then, of course, her mother, too, was a wonderfully talented writer who had a huge impact on her life as well.
Yeah. You can see during the film time, but with some of the archival images and some of her description herself, you can see that their house was a kind of think tank in a way. I mean, people would gather at their house and talk about some pretty advanced ideas of how to look at society and our place among the rest of the societies in the world. She grew up with that going on in her living room.
And in fact, we don't get into this in the film, but Ursula wrote a wonderful essay about the physical, the actual house that she grew up in, which was near the Berkeley campus where her father was a professor. It was a house designed by Bernard Maybeck, the famous Berkeley architect who, of course, designed the Palace of Fine Arts and many other iconic buildings. But he also designed these beautiful homes, one of which she grew up in. And this is a house that has intricate spaces and enclosures and a wonderful kind of warmth and also expansiveness. And she wrote about how the house itself was really conducive to her becoming a writer as a young person.
One thing that's really notable about the film is the flights your film takes into the world of animation to add to the discussion of the worlds that Ursula K. Le Guin created in her writing. Tell me a little bit about your move into the animation component of the film.
So in the documentary, we have two animators, one of whom represents moments or images from the Earthsea books that come into the story. And the other one, there are some fleeting glances into the world of the Dispossessed and the world of the Left Hand of Darkness, which are, of course, other major novels of hers. And we knew that representing these worlds was going to be important and, you know, difficult, because you don't want to ever try to say, this is what she had in mind, or you don't want to say, this is what Earthsea looks like. So we tried to do it in such a way that it was clear that we were presenting sort of one artist's idea of what this fantastic world looks like or could look like. And so we tried to create images that were very fluid, that had the possibility for a viewer to kind of fill in the rest, and that were abstractions in a way, but also representations of these places, so that as we learned about her process and her work, there was that possibility for people watching the film to escape there for a moment. That said, they're not dramatizations of the books or, you know, trying to say that this is what this place looks like. And I am, you know, really pleased to see that one by one, so many of her books are getting turned into Hollywood films or into independent films by directors that she had the opportunity to approve and speak with while she was alive. So I think there's some really exciting representations of her work coming up on the big screen that are not documentary, but that are, you know, going to be chances to really see those worlds in a fictional way.
Can you name the animators?
Yes, I would really like to. Thank you. The animator who illustrated the Earthsea books is named M. Cooper. She's based in London, and she works in oil paint frame by frame. She paints onto a piece of glass. She shoots an actor and then paints a frame, takes a picture of it, paints, wipes it clean, takes another picture, wipes it clean, and then runs them all together to create this very fluid kind of palette of colors that are painted. So you have the sense of being inside of a moving painting.
Yeah, you do.
And it's really beautiful.
Yeah.
I her work is really amazing. And then the other artist is named Molly Schwartz, and she's wonderful too. She's based in New York. And so she worked with us to imagine these worlds that are really, Ursula wanted to always stress, were like real places. So they're not so fantastic as the Earthsea books and the way that we represented them. They're more like, this is a real place that you haven't gone to yet, that you haven't seen, with elements that are different from anything you've seen, and yet you could go there, you could be there.
It's certainly a remarkable writer who can meet you when you're 10 years old and give you something wonderful to read and still be there for you when you're 45 years old and everywhere in between.
To learn to make something well can take your whole life, and it's worth it.
You were so lucky to catch her in the last 10 years of her life.
Yeah.
She sadly passed away just this year, I believe, right?
Ursula passed away in January.
Hmm. Did she get to see any of your film in progress?
Yes, she did. We were working together really right up to the end of her life and collaborating, talking, tangling over sometimes parts of the film that were trickier than others. You know, in explaining her transition into feminism and trying to get it just right, I had, you know, not only the wonderful opportunity to try to represent something of her life on film, but also to work with her, to collaborate with her in that process. I was very lucky to be able to do that. And of course, I wanted her to be able to sit in a theater and see the completed film when it was done.
Yeah.
You know, that was something I wanted very much.
Yeah.
But she did get to see a work in progress just a couple of months before she died. Mm. And I think she knew the direction that I was going in. And I think she was pleased with it. You know, we'll never know.
What's interesting watching the film is she's very much in charge in a positive way, really, not in a pushy, bossy way, but in a very authoritative way. She was very much in charge of the interpretation of her work over the years and her position in the literary canon, in the world of science fiction and then into the world of literature. She was very aware, especially near the end of her life when she was getting such acclaim across the board as an author, not just a science fiction niche author.
I think that's right. I think that Ursula was, you know, aware of how much she affected readers and other writers and many others. She was always a really active participant. She taught other writers. She visited libraries. She did readings. She used her influence and her power. And as her daughter says in the film, she wielded her power very skillfully, like a warrior.
I'd like this not to be resigned, but to be rebellious. I want to see science fiction step over the old walls and head right into the next wall and start to break it down, too.
Worlds of Ursula K. Le Guin screens on Saturday the 22nd at 9 a.m. at the Starlight Room and Sunday at 12:30 p.m. at the American Legion Hall. I spoke to Arwin Curry, the director who worked for 10 years with Ursula K. Le Guin to create this film. KPDZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. I'm Larry Stein. Thanks for being with us for these filmmaker interviews preceding the Port Townsend Film Festival 2018. Next, we'll hear about Intelligent Lives, a film that features Chris Cooper and Marianne Leone Cooper, who you may remember were at the festival a couple of years ago, and they really got to love Port Townsend. And they subsequently worked with the director Dan Habib to do an important film about ability and disability and how we label people and how we dismiss people who have a lot to offer and are often overlooked. Chris Wilson, one of my co-hosts in our live broadcast Friday from 5 to 7, the opening night at the film festival, had a chance to speak to Dan Habib from his home base in New Hampshire.
Our son, Jesse, had cerebral palsy. When Jesse was 4, the neurologist told us that he would never be intellectually normal. We fought to have Jesse included in general education.
This is your Port Townsend Film Festival host, Chris Wilson. Today, I'm pleased to be speaking to Dan Habib. He is the producer and director of a very uplifting and expanding film called Intelligent Lives. He's also working at the University of New Hampshire with the Institute on Disability. Welcome, Dan.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Chris.
So, Dan, can you tell us a little bit about your personal story, what brought you to this work to expand inclusion for children, and tell us about Intelligent Lives?
Thank you. Lots to talk about there. So my my work really grows out of my experience as a parent of my son Samuel. I was actually a photojournalist for 20 years, telling other people's stories, you know, telling documentary stories around the political world here in New Hampshire, where we have the New Hampshire primary, or I did stories on Jamaican migrant workers and welfare reform, all kinds of, you know, topical stories. Never thought I'd tell a story about my own family, but when you have a child with a disability, a lot of things change in your life. And once Samuel was about 2 years old and we realized he had cerebral palsy, my son, I started a film called Including Samuel. It came out in 2008 and changed my whole career. I became a full-time documentary filmmaker, and all of my films focus on telling stories around disability rights, inclusive education, and really human rights for people who have been systematically marginalized in our society, like my son Samuel, you know, in terms of the past around people who had physical and emotional and intellectual disabilities. And people continually ask me, well, what about people who have intellectual disabilities, you know, not like Samuel, who has a physical disability? What if someone has Down syndrome, or what used to be called mental retardation is now called intellectual disabilities? I mean, those people can't really go to school, you know, with their peers or be working. And I got asked that question so many times that I started the project Intelligent Lives that they're showing at the festival.
You've given a TEDx talk. I'd like to mention that for our audience, Disabling Segregation. And that's a great title. And I think that, you know, people go through life and they think that this is an issue that has been solved by legislation. You, on the other side, as a parent, and of course speaking to other people, know this a little differently. How did you come to know and work with our friends Marianne Leone and Chris Cooper, who have been at the Port Townsend Film Festival?
Right. I mean, you're right in that there's been some really strong legislation, like the Americans with Disability Act and the something called IDEA, which is the Individuals with Disability in Education Act, that gave students with disabilities the right to actually go to school in 1975. But the biggest thing that we continue to battle as a society, I think, are low expectations and perceptions of people with disability as being less capable or less intelligent. And I see that all the time with my son Samuel, who uses a wheelchair, uses a communication device because he doesn't speak very easily. But he just graduated from high school and he's going to college as of actually there right now, I think.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. So I think that was the foundation of the film Intelligent Lives, was really examining how we as a society perceive intelligence, especially when it comes to people with disabilities. So I actually met Chris Cooper and Marianne Leone about 10 years ago. My wife and I were at an event in Boston where we were being honored for Including Samuel. Chris and Marianne were very involved in the same organization. And we just started chatting, and we realized that we both shared an experience of parenting kids with cerebral palsy. And in both cases, we always felt that our kids were underestimated because they navigated the world differently, you know, through using a wheelchair and a communication device to communicate, or a computer. You know, we just remained friends for years. But then about 5 years ago, when I started this film, Intelligent Lives, I realized that I wanted to tell the historical perspective on how IQ testing has been used to systematically marginalize people and segregate people, and how intelligence has this very narrow definition in our society of how you score on an IQ test or a standardized test like the SAT, and how it really is very damaging to people with disabilities when they're judged that way. And so I asked Chris whether he would volunteer his time to narrate the historical portions of the film. And Marianne was also very involved in helping to write some of that. But as we started doing that work, Chris and Marianne shared even more about their son, Jesse. And Marianne, you may know, had written a book mm-hmm. called Jesse, A Mother's Story, which is an unbelievably powerful book. But Chris had never really spoken that much publicly about Jesse. And it was difficult for him, I think, emotionally and in many ways, to share such a personal story, because Jesse passed away 13 years ago at age 17 of health issues. But he powered through, and his point of view in the film is just so incredibly powerful in the way they share Jesse's story and how they can describe how IQ testing led people to believe Jesse was so much less competent than he really was. And he ended up becoming a Latin scholar, writing poetry, and much like Samuel, really thriving in school.
Mm-hmm. I know what makes this movie so compelling, and it's not only your personal stories and the Cooper's personal stories, but your three wonderful subjects. And I'd like you to tell us how you found them and what makes their stories so special.
Sure. So I've been doing documentary work now about 30 years between photography and film. The number one most important thing in every project is finding the right subject. It's always finding people that are compelling, that are open, very sometimes difficult and personal and intimate ways, but more than anything, people who have a really compelling story and a story that other people can relate to. And I wanted to find three trailblazers who could show what a whole different perspective on intelligence could look like. And at the beginning of the film, Chris asked this really, I think, provocative question, which is, can any measure of intelligence predict a person's value or ability to contribute meaningfully to the world? And I think Nair, Naomi, and Micah show that there are so many ways that you can contribute in incredible ways to the world, regardless of any score you have on an SAT or an IQ test. So Micah was the first person I identified about 6 years ago, and he is has a vibrant life up at Syracuse, New York. He's going to college. He's actually co-teaching college classes. He's got this great circle of friends who are doctoral students and PhD candidates and graduate mm-hmm. students, and he scored 40 on his IQ when he was a kid.
It's so
which,
incredible.
You know, if you know anything about IQ testing, is quite low. So he was the first paradigm shifter, you know, going to college with an intellectual disability. And then I wanted to find a high school where somebody with significant challenges like autism or another disability could be completely included. And thankfully, there's a tremendous public high school in Boston called the Henderson School that includes every kid regardless of the disability. And Nair Shahid is a young man who's a very talented painter, really handsome, 6'1", really like strong person mm-hmm. who also has autism and has trouble speaking. I was able to show how the school supported his learning, supported his personality, his family's life, and had high expectations for him that allowed him to thrive. And then finally, I needed to find someone that was representing inclusion in the workplace. And I wanted to show someone that was transitioning from something called a segregated sheltered workshop, which is kind of a very controversial model where people with disabilities are all working together, kind of fulfilling orders or doing something in a very segregated environment. And I wanted to find someone who was transitioning out of that classically segregated mm-hmm. environment into an inclusive employment situation. And Naomi, thankfully, was in the midst of that transition from being segregated to being working in a completely welcoming and wonderful community of a beauty school.
Yeah, if you can talk a little bit about Nair, because I want the audience to know that not only does he have autism, but he is African-American. As we listen to the news and we know, you know, this is another aspect of kind of worry and fear for parents.
With all my work, I try to make sure I'm working with a really diverse group of people, and that's mm-hmm. extremely important to me, diverse in every way. So that's about gender, that's about ability and disability, and it's also about race and ethnicity and sexual orientation, for that matter. And so when I started working with Nair, who, as you said, is Black, African-American, you know, it didn't jump out at me that would be kind of an additional layer that he needed to deal with until I started interviewing his teacher, Samuel Teixeira, who's also an African-American man. And I interviewed his parents, Donna and Jamal. And a big theme that continued to come up with was, you know, Nair is doing great in this bubble that we call the Henderson School, you know, where even Samuel Teixeira, the teacher, says, you know, it's kind of like Disneyland. Everyone's nice to each other. Everyone's friendly. But mm-hmm. when he gets out into the larger society, how is he going to be treated as a tall Black man with mm-hmm. unpredictable behavior? Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, there have been some pretty high-profile situations where young adult men with autism who are Black have been shot by police, who have been, you know, caught up in these very horrible situations because the law enforcement didn't understand that they weren't able to communicate in a typical way. So that does become a pretty important theme in the film, as you highlighted. And when I do my documentary films, we don't just put a film and just put it out there and hope things happen. I mean, it's wonderful to be included in festivals like this. But we also have a whole robust take action campaign where people can have discussions on our Facebook group, where people can host screenings in their own community. We're developing educational resources and doing webinars on topics like this, on law enforcement relationships with young adults with disabilities, and on all the different aspects of the film that can help people with disabilities be included. Mm-hmm. So people, if I don't mention it towards the end, I hope people will just go to our website, intelligentlives.org, and all that information is there about how they can participate in our Take Action campaign, which we're calling Opening Doors to Inclusive Education and Employment.
And also, you know, during the showings, the several showings of the movie, on the weekend of the film festival, that information will be made available to all of the viewers and the visitors to Port Townsend. Also, another scene that I want to talk about just briefly is when Micah goes to meet the parents of his girlfriend from his group, from his meetings. Oh, that is just so wonderful. Just everything about that scene was great.
Sure. Well, Micah has this thing called the circle of support. He's been doing it since elementary school, where he's got a group of friends who meets regularly, like once a month or so. He just bounces questions and ideas off them. He asks for advice on academics or work or his social life. That day, he was going to be meeting his girlfriend's family that night for the first time, and he asked his circle of support, what do I talk to them about? You know, what do I say? How do I engage them? And one of his friends says, you know what, just avoid religion and politics. You never want to talk about that with your girlfriend's parents. So lo and behold, in the middle of the get-together, they're sitting around eating pizza, kind of a slightly awkward, tense situation. And it was just before the last presidential election that I filmed it. And so the dad, who was kind of a military guy, says to him, so who are you going to vote for president? And you don't learn this from the film, but I know that Micah was a big Bernie Sanders supporter, so it probably was not going to be Trump. And so he kind of goes, I've been giving that some thought. I'm not really sure yet. And he very adeptly, you know, dodges the question. And I think it was just such a great indication of how Micah, a man who is labeled with this 40 IQ, has some of the most adept interpersonal skills of anyone I've ever seen in my life. And they all have a good laugh and move on.
They do. And it also shows that the dad is thinking of him not as an intellectually disabled adult, but as just, you know, a guy that might be, you know, important to his daughter. And the normalcy of that exchange and others is another thing that makes this film really worth seeing and worth looking up and finding out more about. I want to thank you, Dan, for joining us this morning, and encourage everyone to find out more about this movie and go see it at the Port Townsend Film Festival.
Thank you.
We'll hope to meet you sometime in the future. We'll be looking for more of your work. Thank you.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate the time and interest in this film.
I think because of Naomi's unconditional love for what she does, it's good for everyone.
Are you on Facebook?
No.
Okay.
My parents don't think that's safe.
What do you remember most about today?
BSL.
BSL.
Intelligent Lives, screening Friday at 3:30 at the American Legion Hall and Saturday at 9:30 a.m. at the Key City Public Theater for the free screening venue. Dan Habib is the director of Intelligent Lives. Don't forget to join us on Friday from 5 to 7 p.m. We'll be live out at the opening night at Port Townsend Film Festival on Taylor Street and Washington in the front office of Gooding O'Hara and Mackey Accounting Offices. Thank you so much to them for helping us again this year. I'm Larry Stein, hosting the program. With me on Friday night will be Chris Wilson and Chris Bricker. Enjoy the festival, everybody.